really good to be here. Really great to be able to spend a little bit of time sharing with you. Let me just introduce myself very quickly. I know Gareth's already mentioned the fact that I'm a warden here. Jen, my wife, and Hope and Ella, my girls, we've been part of St. Philip's now for probably just over a year, something like that. And I run, as Gareth mentioned, a charity. And our kind of main program or our main project is called the Naked Truth Project, which is actually all about pornography. But don't worry, that's not what I'm going to talk about today, because before I started running Naked Truth, I've actually probably most of my working life been involved in mission and evangelism in one way or another. So when I was about 18, I started working for a local church doing youth work and things like that. And then after that, I became an itinerant evangelist where I pretty much traveled around the UK kind of doing evangelism and mission with churches. And then Jen and I moved to Manchester in the early 2000s, 2001, and we led an Eden project, which is probably the opposite way of doing mission to what I've been doing before, where we were just rooted in one community, trying to be salt and light in that community. And then after a few more years, I actually stayed with the Message Trust, who kind of pioneered Eden, but my role changed, so I actually became the director of mission, which meant I oversaw the schools, teams, and bands, and that kind of stuff, and the Eden bus project, and prison projects. And so I've probably, in different ways, been involved in different types of evangelism for most of my life, really. So I'm guessing that's probably why Gareth and Lizzie asked me to talk about this bit of the verse that we're thinking about in our series. If you watched last week, you'll know that we're starting a new series based around the verse in Ephesians 4, where it talks about this. It says, "Now these are the gifts that Christ gave the church, the apostles, the evangelists, the prophets, the pastors or shepherds, and the leaders." And this idea that as a church, as a collected group of God's people, that within that, God has kind of put gifts and people who may be able to focus or have a primary drive maybe towards one of those things. And so Gareth unpacked this idea of what an apostle might mean, what that might look like. And if you haven't watched that, I'd really encourage you to go back and watch that talk, because I think we have loads of ideas what an apostle might look like. And some of us might even think, oh, do they even exist anymore in today's world? And so that would be a really important talk to go back and watch. But similarly, I think the word evangelist conjures up loads of ideas in our minds as well. And I don't know what you think of when you think of the word evangelist, or you think of an evangelist, what picture you might get in your head. Maybe you think of that man or woman on the streets in Manchester City Centre, maybe with a kind of like funny microphone and a little boombox, kind of shouting at people, telling them that, you know, they need to get saved. Maybe that's the image you have. Maybe you think of that kind of front man or woman of a Christian band who does a little preach at the end of a Christian concert and asks people to put their hands up. Maybe that's your idea of what an evangelist is. Maybe you think about a person who knocks on doors and kind of tries and talks to whoever happens to answer the door. We have loads of different images, I think, when it comes to this word evangelist. And then we kind of have to extend that to what does it mean to have the gift of the evangelist? I mean, that's even more confusing for a lot of us, isn't it? And because probably we've heard things like this over the years. If you've been around church for a little while, maybe you've heard people say, well, you know, maybe we're not all evangelists, but we're all called to do evangelism. And you're like, well, what's the difference there then? What's the difference between being an evangelist and just doing evangelism? And so there's definitely a load of questions, I think, around this. And so what I want to do today in the time that I've got is to just unpack that a little bit. And maybe you're one of the people right now, you're watching this, you're going, at last, someone's going to start talking about evangelism. Maybe you feel you've got that gift of the evangelist and you're going, come on in, sock it to them. Because you're frustrated, actually. You're frustrated because you wish that generally the whole church was doing a lot more when it came to evangelism. They were talking more, they were preaching more, they're going out there more. And so you're kind of waiting for maybe that talk that is going to encourage people to get out there, do more evangelism. Maybe you're going, oh no, now I'm just going to feel guilty. Maybe you don't feel you have that gift of the evangelist and you're thinking, oh man, I know I should be doing more. I know I should be talking about Jesus more. I know that I need to kind of somehow share my faith more. And now I'm just going to kind of feel that even in a greater way. And actually, I think for today, as I was praying about today and what to share today, I'll be honest with you, I'm probably not aiming this talk at those of you that perhaps feel you've got a heart for evangelism or even the gift of the evangelist. And I'll also be really honest with you, I'm not sure that kind of socking it to them tends to help people much either. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to do something pretty simple. And we're going to try our best just to spend some time thinking about how can we make evangelism less difficult. It's as simple as that. How can we make evangelism less difficult? For those of you maybe who've got the gift, who kind of feel the drive, the passion for evangelism, be encouraged, because hopefully what will happen is if the more of the church can just feel like evangelism is less difficult, then hopefully what's going to happen is more people are going to start to hear about Jesus, and hopefully that's going to excite you. But if you're one of those people saying, well, I don't even know if this is me, I definitely don't feel like I've got the gift of evangelism, then actually today, hopefully, you're going to go, actually, maybe this isn't as hard as I can sometimes feel it is. And so to help us do that and to help us start to imagine how we could make evangelism less difficult, we're going to look at one of my favorite kind of stories from one of the Gospels, in the Gospel of John. And we're going to look at John 9. And I'm going to just talk you through this story. If you haven't got your Bible in front of you, then don't worry, I'm going to tell you the story. But if you have, then it's just those first verses of John chapter 9. And it's the story of when Jesus heals a man who was born blind. And what I'd love you to do as we kind of think about this story is just imagine for a minute being that guy. Imagine being that man. And maybe you want to close your eyes, you know, imagine what it's like to be blind. If you're still wearing your pajamas and you've only been awake for half an hour, maybe don't close your eyes, because that could be deadly. But the rest of us, maybe just kind of close your eyes. Imagine that darkness that you see as you close your eyes. That is all this man has ever known his whole life. And what we know about this man is that he lives in Jerusalem. He lives with his parents, so we don't really know how old he was. He's called a man, but that he could be 14 years old in Jewish culture and be called a man. And what we also know is that because of his predicament, because he is blind, because he lives in a culture where there's no welfare state, there's no support for those who are disabled outside a community of their close family, he spends most of his time begging. He needs to ask for money. He can't work. He needs to ask for money. And that's where we actually find him in the story. He's probably sitting on the street, on this side of the street, begging. And what happens is that it's a festival in Jerusalem, which means that a whole load of the country actually travel to Jerusalem, and they go to the temple for certain kind of services and things like that. And so the city would have been absolutely heaving. It would have been hot. It would have been heaving, full of people. And I want you to imagine, if you're this man, that you've just all day heard voices and people and bustle, but then you kind of hear some voices and you hear some accents. You recognize the accents. They're kind of country bumpkins from Galilee. And they seem to be, these country bumpkins, talking about you. Because you can kind of hear them sort of saying, well, whose fault's that then? Is it like his parents' fault? Were they the sinners? Or is he the sinner? Why is this guy blind? So that is what this guy's hearing. And he's kind of thinking, oh, here we go. You know, maybe he hears this sort of thing a lot. I don't know. But then the next thing he hears is a strange noise, and maybe was that, what was it? You know, was that a camel clearing its throat, or was it something else? And then maybe he hears even just some people in the crowd saying, oh, did you see that? Did you see that? That northerner, he just spat on the floor, and now he's picked it up in his hands, and he's rubbing it around in his hands, a typical. But before this blind man can say or do anything, he feels something wet and warm on his eyes. And then he hears a voice, and it's one of those country bumpkins. And the voice says this, it says, right, what I want you to do now is I want you to just go down to the road there and wash your eyes out in the pool of Siloam. Okay? Now, that's it. That's all John says that Jesus said, is that he tells him to wash his eyes out. And so we read in John 9 that that's what the man does. Whether he did it immediately, whether he thought about it for a while, whether he thought this seems just stupid, we don't really know that bit. But he goes to the Pool of Siloam, and I want you to imagine this. He leans over the little wall that would have been built probably around that pool, and he dips his hand into the water. And as water's kind of trickling through his fingers, imagine how he's feeling right now, because right now he's just got like a mud pack on his eyes, so he's going to have softer skin, great. But is he going to change? Is something going to happen? Is there going to be a miracle? Is there going to be a moment? And so it's make or break for this moment, for this man, as he starts to kind of pull away the bits of mud that have dried on his eyelids. And I don't know at what point he knew the miracle had happened. Maybe before he even opens his eyes, he knows something has changed, because suddenly instead of that darkness, now there's just like a pinkness, as he can see the inside of his eyelids as the sun is shining. We don't know. It just says that he opens his eyes. But imagine it. Imagine for the first time in his life, this man can see. And then John, in this really understated way, says, and so the man came home seeing. That's how John puts it. I mean, I want you to imagine even that. What was that walk home like for this guy who has never been able to see his whole life? What would that be like? He's kind of walking along, and I can just imagine every now and then just stopping and just going, what is that? And like this crowd who must have been buzzing around him because they've not seen anything like this for a while, they're going, what's the big deal? You know, it's a tree. And he's like, yeah, I know, but I've bumped into them my whole life. I had no idea at the top they're so pointy. His life was completely changed. And throughout kind of like church history, people kind of use this story actually as an analogy of kind of like the spiritual transformation that can happen in people's lives. You know, John Newton famously writes, I once was blind, but now I see. And he's not talking about physical sight. He's talking about spiritual sight and revelation. He's talking about his conversion from being an atheist slave trader to being someone who loves and follows Jesus. And so I want us to take this story for 15 minutes or so, we're just going to grab a few bits from it, okay? And that's going to help us, hopefully, think about how we can make evangelism a little less difficult for you and for me. So what can we learn from this story? Well, the first one I just wanted to mention is this, that one of the ways that we make evangelism less difficult is simply as we learn to recognize an opportunity. You see, what's really interesting in this story is that the disciples are talking about this man. You know, they're having a bit of a theological discussion, actually, and they're having a conversation about him. But Jesus doesn't just talk about him. He does a bit, but of course what he does is he talks to him. He sees that there's something happening that he needs to make the most of. He sees an opportunity here. He knows that actually God can do something amazing and beautiful and wonderful in this moment, and he grabs that moment. I love that. I love the fact that in this story we see Jesus do something that perhaps the disciples wouldn't have done. They would have just carried on walking up the road, you know, talking about this guy. But Jesus sees, he recognizes, he maybe hears the whisper of the Spirit. Maybe he just gets a sense from his Father that, no, this is a moment. This is a moment where I want to do something. I mean, he almost says it in so many words, where he kind of says, you know, this has happened. This moment has happened so that the glory of God can be revealed. So Jesus has learned in his day-to-day life, as maybe he gets up and prays each morning, but he's learned to look and to recognize and see, what is the Father doing? What is it that I need to do to respond to that? That is one of the things we learn, I think, about Jesus, and we see it in this moment here. And that's a real challenge for me, because I think throughout my life, I've kind of, you know, known that evangelism's important, but sometimes I've struggled to know when's the right time. You know, when's the right time to talk to somebody about faith? When's the right time to share who Jesus is or what he's like? I remember when we used to do kind of youth work and stuff on Eden, and we one of the team would lead a football team with a load of the local lads. And every Saturday, you know, they'd go and play in a league and all that kind of stuff. You know, and I used to kind of remind this guy that, you know, what he was doing was brilliant. But he used to kind of feel this pressure because he thought, like, but we're not talking about Jesus enough. And I remember we had a conversation where it was just like, well, what are you expecting? You know, are you thinking that, you know, when the team lose sort of 13-0 to some other team, that, you know, you get all the lads together and you go, okay, lads, you were beaten. You were beaten bad today. But you know what? So was Jesus. Just before he died for you. I mean, it's just, we can feel like, are we getting it wrong if we don't talk about Jesus every moment? But that's actually sometimes not what it means to recognize an opportunity. I take comfort from this verse in Colossians 4, where Paul talks about this. He talks about prayer, and he says this. He says, devote yourselves to pray, being watchful and thankful. And pray for us too, that God may open the door for our message, so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I'm enchained. Pray that I proclaim it clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. There's a lot in this verse, but I think there are two things for us to think about. One is, if we just do what he talks about, if we just pray, if we just say, God, help me to see the opportunities, I think you'll be surprised. I think you'll be surprised how actually your day starts to open up. But also notice this other thing that he says is just pray that I make the most of every opportunity. He doesn't say pray that I make more opportunities. He says pray that I make the most of the opportunities. Now, sometimes I think it is right that we as church and as individuals, we try and create opportunities to talk about Jesus. I think that's actually a really good thing. But a lot of the time, I think we just need to kind of make the most of the opportunities that God gives us. He's already at work. He's already doing stuff in people's lives. And sometimes it's just about us praying, God, help me to see it, help me to recognize it, and then make the most of it. And if you struggle with the idea of evangelism, don't beat yourself up that you're not making all these opportunities to talk about Jesus when you're kind of chatting to people at work or on end of a Zoom call. Hi, yeah, just before we leave, can I just tell you about Jesus? Don't worry about it. What you need to do is just say, God, help me today, just as Paul did, help me today to make the most of the opportunities that you're going to present me with. Help me to recognize those opportunities. Next thing that I kind of want us to think about is from this story, as well as recognizing those opportunities, praying and asking God to help us make the most of them, is actually learning to meet people where they are. I don't know if you've ever, when you heard that story of the blind man, if you've ever wondered, why does Jesus spit? Because he does. He kind of spits on the floor and he makes this little mud pack out of his spit and the dirt and he puts it on the blind man's eyes. Actually, in another story, we find out that Jesus doesn't even bother with the mud. He just kind of spits directly in the guy's face, a different blind man. So why does Jesus do that? And some people, you know, my nan, for example, she'd probably read that and go, oh dear, no, not my Lord. He wouldn't spit. But he does. He does do it. So why does he do it? You know, is there something holy? Is there something magical about the spit? Well, no, we don't think there is really, because obviously at other times Jesus just prays for someone to be healed and there's no spit involved. So why? Why does he do it? Well, the kind of Bible boffins and the theologians have got a few ideas about this, but one of the things that people talk about is that maybe actually it was a symbolic act. That actually, in the time and the culture, what used to happen is that people, as we even heard the disciples talking about, they believed that if someone had a disability, it was perhaps because they were being punished by God. That was kind of like the belief system that was kind of in the zeitgeist, if you like. And one of the things Jesus does in this moment is he kind of changes that and challenges that opinion. But because that existed, probably what used to happen is that religious and righteous people would walk past somebody like this blind man on their way to the temple, and they would actually probably spit on him. Almost as a way of just saying, look, obviously there's something wrong with you. God has punished you, and I just want to make sure you don't forget it. And then they'd spit. And so actually, perhaps as this blind man heard, you know, that noise that Jesus was making before he spat. I wonder if he, at this point, he's going, oh, here we go again. I hear this all the time. This is just what happens because I'm hated by God. I'm being punished by God. And so people want to remind me of that truth. But actually, of course, what we see Jesus do is he uses spit to reverse that curse. What he does is he uses this spit to say, you've not been pushed out by God. In fact, God is coming to you. Because there's an actual really important point that we need to understand here. And that's that this blind man never would have been into the temple where the Jews believed the presence of God was because of his disability. He wouldn't have been allowed through the doors. But Jesus himself, the temple, God's presence himself, God himself, leaves the building, if you like, and comes straight to the man on the streets. And so what we kind of see here are some really important things. Because what we see is this man suddenly finding out that God has come to him where he is, both physically on the street, but also actually emotionally and spiritually. He thought that God hated him, and Jesus understood that, met him in that understanding, and then begins to change that understanding. And of all things, he uses spit to do it. So what does that mean for us? Well, one of the things I think we need to remember is that times have changed. People don't just turn up to church in the way that they used to. I remember when I first started working for a church and I was in charge of the youth work like Joel was, and I was, you know, really keen and desperate for people to come and join the youth club and all that kind of thing. And there was this older guy in the church, and he kind of said to me one Sunday, "Son, let me tell you something. When I was leading the youth work, there used to be hundreds and hundreds of young people coming along to the youth group. Let me tell you why." And I'm like, "Yes, brilliant. You know, this guy is going to mentor me. He's going to give me the secret sauce. He's going to tell me how to get hundreds of young people to come to church. This is brilliant. This is what I've been waiting for." And then he told me what they did. He said, "What we used to do, son, is this. Open the doors and let them in." Thanks a lot. That's really, really helpful. But actually, what it reminded me of is that times have changed. People don't just turn up to church, like I said, which means that we, if we want to meet people where they are, we need to be like Jesus. We can't just wait for them to come to the temple. We need to actually go and meet them where they are physically. Which is why, for example, the work we do with the community outreach programs, you know, work with vulnerable women, the stuff we do in the local schools, the stuff that we're doing with Bags of Hope, going to people's homes. That's so important because we can't just wait for people to come to us. But also, it's not just about where people are physically at. It's also about where they're at in their spiritual journey and meeting them at that point as well. There was a guy called James Engel, and he came up with something that was called the Engel scale. And what that scale was really a kind of a spectrum, if you like, that kind of mapped out where people might be on a spiritual journey towards accepting Jesus and then beyond. Now, I've kind of rewritten it a little bit for today just to kind of help us think this question through a little bit. So this isn't the Engel scale. This is the Hendy scale, okay? It's a little bit different. But you'll kind of see it on the screen. And I'm going to briefly talk you through it as well, okay? So if you can throw that up on the screen, that's great. But don't worry if you can't see it very clearly because I'm going to just talk us through it really quickly as well. So on Engel used to do it where it started at minus 10. So someone who was on minus 10, a person who that you would be on that scale at minus 10, I would say is someone who would say these words. They would say, "God isn't real. Religions are offensive, manipulative, and dangerous." You might know some people, you know, some kind of, people who absolutely believe that, you know, are kind of like atheists, just totally that's where they would place themselves. Minus 9 is, "I don't care if God is real, and I don't care if you're a Christian." Minus 8 is, "God isn't real, but Christians who don't shove it down your throat are okay." Minus 7 is, "There's something out there, you know, supreme beings, ghosts, that sort of thing." Minus 6 is, "Christians are okay. Got some ideas about what Christians believe, and I'm glad it works for them, but it's not for me." Maybe you know some people who would be at that point on the scale. Minus 5 is, "I believe in some of it, but I've got big questions, and I don't want to change my lifestyle." Minus 4 is I'm up for finding out more. Jesus seems amazing, but I'm a bit freaked out by Christians. You might go, hang on a minute, that's me. I thought I was a Christian, but this is kind of where someone might be. I'm on -4. -3 would be, I know my life isn't sorted. I want God to change things. I just don't want to or feel that I can change. -2 is, I know I need to do something, but it feels like a huge step of faith. -1 is, becoming a Christian is the best thing I can do with my life. So you're like going, and? Yeah. But for whatever reason, that person, they've told you that, but they still haven't made a commitment. And you're like, what is it? But then after that, you kind of then go into, I've put Jesus front and center of my life. And then it kind of goes on actually into the pluses, but we won't talk about that now. Now, truth is, you probably know people who are at different points on that scale, that if you talk to them, they would reveal little nuggets in those conversations that would help you understand, oh, actually, this person doesn't even believe in God. Now, the reason why that's really important is because if you think evangelism is telling somebody, you know, God loves you and he'll forgive you for your sins if you, you know, commit yourself to him, right? Well, that's true. That's part of what the gospel is about. But if someone doesn't even believe in God, then telling them that God loves them probably doesn't really matter very much to them. Or telling them that they can be forgiven by a deity that they don't think exists. So I don't need forgiveness from something that doesn't exist. So where we start our conversation is massively influenced by where that person is at in their current understanding or belief. Equally, you know, if someone's -5 or -4, you know, they believe in some of it, but they've got questions or they're up for finding out more, they're the kind of person that Alpha would be brilliant for example. They would be so good to invite to Alpha. So one of the most important things we can do to try and help people and meet them where they're at is not actually to talk to them, but to listen to them. You know, I think some of the best evangelism starts when we start listening to where our friends are at. We have conversations, we pay attention to what they say. Maybe we ask some questions that might lead into that conversation. But rather than us going, oh, great, right, well, let me tell you, actually what we're trying to do initially is just figure out where might they be in this scale. But also another really important thing and just an encouragement for you is you might be operating in the gift of the evangelist and you might not even have a clue. Because you think the evangelist is someone who brings someone from -2 to sort of like 0 on that scale. You know, the person who somehow always seems to kind of do the prayer of commitment with people. And that is obviously really important and beautiful when God gives us the opportunity to do it. But actually, maybe most of your friends and family are actually on -9. And so actually what you're doing most of the time through your words and your actions is helping them move from -9 to -8. Maybe because of you and your words and your actions, they'll start to understand that God might be real, that they might start to even believe in God in the first place. And do you know what? That's evangelism too. We just don't celebrate it as much. We don't notice it as much. But it's vital. In fact, I'd argue it's maybe even harder than bringing someone from -1 to 0, because someone who's -1 has been on such a long journey anyway. But actually, those people who are kind of at -9 and -8, they're kind of so hard to stuff that actually you being there for them, you talking about stuff could actually be the most, the real evangelists need to be there. So just remember that, be encouraged by that. Also remember this, the Church of England coalition with some other organizations like Hope and others, did a survey a couple of years ago called Talking to Jesus or Just Jesus or something like that. I got it written down, but I can't remember what it was called. But one of the statistics that came out of that was that they surveyed non-Christians and they found out that 1 in 5 non-Christians said they would be open to an encounter or an experience of Jesus after having a conversation with someone they know about him. In other words, we sometimes think our friends don't want to know, but actually I think a lot of them do. They really do. We've just got to kind of understand where they are and meet them where they are. Let me just close with a final thing or a final thought, and it's simply this. The last thing that we can do is remember the good news. Now, that sounds what? So do I need to kind of learn the gospel, you know? Do I need to kind of do some gospel kind of training and learn, remember how to share the good news? Well, sometimes it's that. But do you know what? Again, I think sometimes it's as simple as this. It's as simple as saying, I've just got to remember that what I've got is good news. So rather than I've got to remember the gospel as a, you know, Jesus died, you've sinned, all that kind of thing. But instead, just remember that the word gospel means good news. That's what it actually means. See, I wonder when the blind guy went home, it must have been amazing, incredible. You know, imagine the first time he saw his mum's face and he saw her smile and the wrinkles around her eyes. Imagine the first time he saw a sunset. I mean, he must have just been like going, whoa, the world's about to blow up. I've only just sort of like seeing it. And like his friend next to him is going, oh, no, there was a better one last week. You see, I wonder how long it took for the things that were completely awe-inspiring for him to just become normal. You know, he stopped noticing things. He stopped being blown away by the trees because it just became normal to him. It certainly would have been the case of his friends when he was like going, wow, and they're going, what's the big deal? You know, it's a rock. You know, one of the problems we have, particularly those of us that have been around the church for a while, is that we can sometimes just forget how amazing the good news actually is. You know, when you've sung hundreds of hymns and you've heard hundreds of sermons about forgiveness and love and the goodness of God, if we're really honest, we can just get a little bit like, yeah, that's good, isn't it? And we can forget that for someone who's blind, for someone who doesn't know what it's like to be loved unconditionally by someone, because right now their life is about, I only feel loved when I do stuff to earn it, or I only feel self-worth if people actually look at me in a certain way, or for people who feel like they have messed up their life because they've burnt bridges and broken relationships and they think there's just no going back now, to hear that there's an opportunity for a new start and for forgiveness and wholeness, these things can actually be mind-blowing for people. But because we've heard it so many times, we're just like, yeah, it's quite good that, isn't it, that God loves us and stuff. And so what we don't then think is, I've got to tell someone about this because it would blow their mind, because actually familiarity has breeded a little bit of, dare I say, even boredom for us, let alone contempt. And so part of this is just realizing, do you know what? This is amazing. More people than we realize do want to know about this. They really do. They really want to know that there is somebody who loves them unconditionally. They want to know that they can be made whole, that they can know peace, that they can know have a new life and a new start. We've just got to remind ourselves that that's the news we've got and that it's good. So what can we do as I close now? What can we do? Well, there's just two words I want you to remember, and it's simply this. Even in COVID, you can do these things. Simply this. Invest and invite. Invest and invite. What do I mean by that? Well, invest is simply this. Invest in the relationships and the people that God has put in your world. That means praying for them, getting to know their names, find out the names of the people in your street and your neighborhood. Ask yourself a question. When you last did something socially, how many non-Christians were involved? Or was it just all your mates from church? So sometimes it's about investing your time into some non-Christian friends that you've got, just spending more time with them. Sometimes it's just praying for them and asking God to meet them where they are. To invest in them is so important, and you can start today doing that. And then invite. Why not just invite them to things? Invite them to join Alpha. Why not? As Andre said, they might say no, but they're probably not going to then never talk to you again. But you never know. It could be one of those one in five from that survey that are going, actually, I want to know. Maybe they're minus four on the Engle scale and they're asking questions already. Maybe they're minus nine, but the fact that you've even shown that you're interested in them and you want to have conversations about God's stuff might open up another conversation another time with you or with someone else. So just inviting is so, so important. And it's probably easier than trying to remember how to share the gospel properly. So if that scares you, the idea of sharing the gospel, then just invite. Invite them to Alpha. Invite them along to something. Share a good talk that you find online. Just share it with somebody you know, a family member or something. Why don't we just learn to make evangelism a little less difficult.